So our next presentation is bound to engender some questions. It's HIV-1 infection with multi-class resistance despite pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. The presenter is Dr. David Knox. He's a HIV primary care provider at the Maple Leaf Medical Clinic in Toronto.
Good morning. First, I'd like to thank the CROI organizers for allowing us to inviting us to speak about this case report as a late breaker abstract. Am I just clicking this?
No, the green button.
The green button. Perfect. Thank you. Okay, these are our disclosures. The use of combined emtricitabine and tenofovir diazoxide fumarate, or FTC-TDF, for HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis is reported to have nearly 100% prevention efficacy in men who have sex with men when adherence is high. True breakthrough infections have been suspected only rarely and are difficult to prove due to limitations in documenting the long-term adherence to PrEP. The detection of TDF in plasma alone has been associated with a 92% risk reduction in HIV acquisition. Tenofovir diphosphate, or TFVDP, in dried blood spots represents the cumulative dosing of TDF over 1 to 3 months. It therefore has the advantage of being able to measure the longer-term adherence to PrEP. Dried blood spots corresponding to the daily use of PrEP have demonstrated a 100% risk reduction in HIV infection. No study to date has definitively documented a breakthrough HIV infection in the context of consistent adherence to PrEP. Today, we report a 43-year-old male who seroconverted to multi-class resistant HIV-1 after 24 months of successful PrEP, despite clinical and pharmacokinetic data suggesting long-term adherence to PrEP. This 43-year-old male had a past medical history of depression, anxiety, and herpes labialis. He was on escitalopram, bupropion, and valacyclovir as needed. In February of 2013, prior to initiating PrEP, he had a non-reactive fourth-generation HIV-1-2 antigen-antibody combo screen. 2 months later, in April of 2013, and after a reported 3-month period of abstinence, the patient initiated FTC-TDF as HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis. He subsequently had 7 non-reactive fourth-generation screening tests prior to his first reactive test in May of 2015. We're going to call this day zero. Day zero had a positive screen, a P24 antigen that was positive, a confirmatory P24 antigen that was reactive, and a Western blot that was negative. We're going to narrow in on the scale here. Between 2 and 6 weeks prior to the reactive HIV screen, the patient reported multiple acts of anal receptive sex with casual partners without the use of condoms. The patient did not have classic acute HIV seroconversion illness, however, did have intermittent severe epigastric pain. One such episode led him to the emergency department with a fever of 101 Fahrenheit, and a CT scan of the abdomen was ordered and revealed thickening of the sigmoid colon, ascending colon, and rectum. Subsequent bidirectional endoscopy revealed erythematous patches of the sigmoid colon. Biopsies were taken, and they were considered negative. We repeated HIV serology on day 7. The P24 antigen was now negative, just below the lower limit to declare it a positive, and the Western blot remained negative. On day 9, we added darunavir, ritonavir, and raltegravir to the FTC-TDF because we were concerned that there could be baseline NRTI mutations and resistance here. And at this point, as the treating provider, I became concerned that this could be a true breakthrough HIV infection in the context of PrEP because my patient was adamant that he'd been adherent to his PrEP over the preceding 24 months. So to investigate this and distinguish it from an alternative scenario of HIV infection due to non-adherence to PrEP, which we've seen multiple times in the literature, we collected his pharmacy dispensing records, and we obtained informed consent from the patient to proceed with a series of other investigations. Those investigations included dried blood spots, which we collected 24 days after first detected HIV infection and 20 days after the patient learned of his HIV status, and 16 days after the addition of darunavir, ritonavir, and raltegravir. We also did liquid chromatography mass spectrometry on the untimed plasma sample from day 0 to determine the TDF and FTC concentrations. Importantly, this was a day when the patient was unaware of his HIV status. Standard population sequencing and independently deep sequencing was performed on a viral load of 28,000 copies from day 7. We performed phenotypic drug resistance testing to the integrase class of medications on day zero plasma. These are our results. Pharmacy dispensing records demonstrated routine and on-time prescription refills. To aid in our dried blood spot analysis, we calculated an expected concentration under the assumption that the patient was in fact not taking his PrEP prior to learning of his HIV status, and therefore would be starting from zero. The expected concentration of TFVDP for 20 days of therapy is 722 femtomoles per punch, with an interquartile range of 578 to 920 femtomoles per punch. The observed concentration in our patient's dried blood spots was 2,297 femtomoles per punch, and this is consistent with steady state levels of TFVDP. Liquid chromatography mass spectrometry results were initially inconclusive on our day zero plasma, and this is because the only assay we had available to us at the time had a high lower limit of quantification, and it was an untimed plasma sample relative to the patient's last dose. However, in the spirit of a late-breaking abstract, in the last 10 days we've been able to repeat this sample on a second, more sensitive assay, and it did show that there was TDF at 152 nanograms per milliliter and FTC that was actually above the limit of quantification for this assay. These are our baseline resistance. Standard consensus sequencing revealed these mutations, and independently, deep sequencing confirmed these mutations did not identify any mutations at low frequencies in the viral pool. So in the NRTI class, the mutations there confer resistance to emtricitabine and a reduced response to tenofovir. NNRTI mutations conferred resistance to nevirapine. There were no significant PI class mutations, and integrase strand transfer inhibitor mutations at baseline demonstrated or conferred resistance to L-vitegravir and a reduced response to raltegravir and dolutegravir. This was a clade B virus considered CCR5 tropic. So phenotypic drug resistance testing was completed on the INSTI class. The red lines here represent the expected percent inhibition of viral replication in the presence of increasing concentrations of raltegravir, L-vitegravir, and dolutegravir with a control strain of HIV-1. The blue lines here represent our patient's results, the results for our patient's virus. And as you can see, there was a 2.7, 9.6, and greater than 100-time fold change in the percent inhibition in the presence of raltegravir, dolutegravir, and L-vitegravir, respectively. Phylogenetic analysis revealed that this was consistent with infection from a single source. So our patient actually had viral suppression on 21 days of therapy with FTC, TDF, darunavir, ritonavir, and raltegravir. However, after we received the genotype results, he was optimized to dolutegravir, combined darunavir and cobicistat and rilpivirine. His viral load remains undetectable to date. We repeated the Western blot at 37 days, and it was indeterminate, and at 130 days, it returned positive. So moving on to discussion points. The dried blood spot observed TFVDP concentrations were substantially greater than the expected concentrations for 20 days of therapy with TDF-FTC. This suggests that there were substantial amounts of TFVDP in the patient's red blood cells in the 1 to 3 months prior, which would have overlapped with the patient's clinical and laboratory seroconversion. Previous literature has demonstrated that dried blood spot concentrations of only 700 femtomoles per punch have been associated with protection from HIV. Now, we know that the concentration of TDF in the plasma will increase when co-administered with darunavir and ritonavir and will decrease with the co-administration of raltegravir, but we feel that the net effect of this is modest relative to the dramatic observed over expected concentrations demonstrated. The baseline NNRTI and integrase strand transfer inhibitor mutations suggest that this was a case of transmitted rather than acquired resistance. There were multiple TAMs at baseline that were not known to be selected for by FTC or TDF. Importantly, the presence of the 215E mutation, which is a revertant of the 215YF mutation, is known to evolve in the absence of NRTIs and is a commonly reported transmitted mutation. So its presence also supports the conclusion that this is a case of transmitted resistance. And overall, our patient's resistance profile suggests that he was exposed to somebody who was failing a regimen of TDF, FTC, L-vitegravir, and cobicistat, or STRIBUILD. We know that transmitted INST mutations are rare. However, 5 out of 6 of the new DHHS recommended regimens for antiretroviral naive patients are integrase based. So whether or not we're going to see an increase in baseline mutations to the integrase class is not yet known. But this case of HIV breakthrough infection with baseline resistance to L-vitegravir suggests that we should increase baseline resistance to the, resistance testing to the integrase class because it has implications not just for the treatment of HIV but also for the prevention with both PEP and PrEP. So implications for PrEP scale-up. The ability to study rare events that occur during PrEP treatment has to be balanced with the feasibility of storing HIV non-reactive samples for potential future analysis. As we look towards how PrEP may evolve in the future, it's important to understand how breakthrough infections today and the baseline resistance to the integrase class may impact the efficacy of PrEP options available to us in the future, like cabotegravir. So there were limitations in our study. One of the limitations was that we were only able to study samples from the time of HIV diagnosis and beyond, and that's because this is an infection that occurred in the community, and our public health laboratory does not store HIV non-reactive samples. Additionally, we had very limited sample volumes from day 0 and day 7, and that precluded phenotypic drug resistance testing to other classes of antiretrovirals. Our dried blood spots were collected 20 days after the patient learned of his HIV status. Ideally, dry blood spots would have been collected throughout the 24 months the patient was on PrEP and very soon after his reactive HIV screening test. So in conclusion, the clinical history, pharmacy records, the mass spec results consistent with recent dosing, the dried blood spot results consistent with long-term dosing of FTC-TDF suggest that HIV infection is in fact possible despite adherence to oral daily PrEP. And to our knowledge, this is the first reported case of breakthrough HIV infection with evidence of long-term adherence to PrEP. Failure of PrEP in this case was likely due to the transmission of a PrEP-resistant, multi-class resistant strain of HIV-1. There's a lot of people to thank for this case, but I just first and foremost would like to thank the case patient in Toronto, Dr. Robert Grant for his guidance in San Francisco, Tony Mazzulli in Toronto, and a big thank you to my colleagues at Maple Leaf Medical, Drs. Jason Brunetta, Barry Merkley, and Graham Smith for their clinical guidance. Thank you.
Thank you. It's now open for questions. Please state your name.
Ken Mayer from Boston. Very interesting and informative case. Do you have any data around sexually transmitted infections around the time of acute infection and also prior to infection?
Yes. So time limitations didn't let me include that information in this presentation, but 6 months prior to the first reactive screening test, the patient had negative STI screening. That included pharyngeal and rectal cultures for chlamydia and gonorrhea. Syphilis testing was negative in the past and remained non-reactive throughout his treatment with PrEP. And chlamydia, gonorrhea, urine NATs were negative. So there was no evidence of STIs.
Back.
Yes. Thank you. Walid Hanani, CDC. What is probably missing from your extensive work out of the case is the phenotypic data on tenofovir and FTC from the early time points.
Yeah.
And this is probably critical because it gives us a real information on the in vitro susceptibility of this virus to both drugs. And if I can point out also some relevant information from macaque models, with a 184V only challenge virus, FTC-TDF was retained full activity, PrEP activity. And we only saw reduction in activity with the K65R virus. So, and the fact that 184V can resensitize the virus to tenofovir, it's probably very relevant in your case to home in on the exact susceptibility to both drugs because of interactions between the TAMs and the 184V mutation in this virus.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. We had incredibly limited sample volumes from day 0 and day 7 to work with. And we had to basically prioritize our phenotypic drug resistance testing, and we thought the integrase story was pretty interesting. So, but you're right, that would complete the story here.
Probably some amplification and recombinant virus testing from the DBS should probably give you the answer.
Thank you.
Gus Cairns from AIDSMAP. I've got two questions. One was similar to Waleed's. He was resistant to a lot of things, but he wasn't that resistant from what you were able to tell to tenofovir. So, the breakthrough is not necessarily explained by that resistance data. But the other thing is, as a community writer, I know people are going to misinterpret me saying that it takes 8 weeks to build to get to peak levels of drug in after you've started taking PrEP. Can you explain exactly what the dried blood spots measure? Because this is, a much longer build-up to peak level than the tissue build-ups to steady state that we're usually writing about.
Mm-hmm. So the dried blood spot analysis basically gives you a better understanding of the patient's long-term adherence. I put in the interquartile ranges there. So next to the next to our patient's results, there was the interquartile range for a steady state level at 8 weeks, and the patient was significantly above that. Does that answer the question?
No. what is the significance of the 8 weeks? Because, we're used to saying you get to peak levels within a week.
Yeah, I think that's what we have data on right now. I don't think Peter... is Peter Anderson here? Yes, he is. He can answer that question. Excellent.
So, the half-life of tenofovir diphosphate in the red blood cell is 17 days. So with repeated dosing, it takes about 8 weeks to finally reach the plateau. And this person was much before that, so we don't think he was near. Had he started from zero, he wouldn't have been close to that plateau that he would have reached.
Thanks. That's very helpful.
Thank you.
It was a beautiful case presentation. It's Paul Sachs from Boston. I thought... One of your comments, though, in your discussion, I'm not sure we're ready to have to do baseline genotypic testing for integrase. A case like this does not kind of make that point. What really would make the point is if surveillance studies start showing that a lot of people who are tested at baseline had integrase resistance, and so far, fortunately, it's been incredibly rare. So when you look at large databases of treatment-naive patients, clinically significant integrase resistance is uncommon. So.
Yeah, and we don't have that data yet out of Toronto, but it's something that we're looking into as well.
No, we'll keep an eye on those databases, but they're so far reassuring. Thank you.
Thank you. Frontline.
Bob Grant, San Francisco. Congratulations on a great presentation. And working up a clinical case from a practice, it's amazingly heroic on your part and the part of the patient, who I think was amazingly courageous in sharing his story with people. My question really is about what can you tell us about the prevalence of multi-drug resistant HIV in recently infected people or people failing virologic therapy in Toronto? As I reviewed the literature anticipating your presentation, it looked to me like viruses that have 5 TAMs and M184V are only seen in less than 1%, probably 0.4% of recently infected people. And certainly your case suggests that whatever our estimate of efficacy was of PrEP as used, it should be discounted for the prevalence of multi-drug resistant HIV, which might be 0.4%. So, I'm just curious. What do you know about Toronto ecology?
Yeah, there's actually minimal data out there right now. The numbers I feel confident quoting would be Province of Ontario data, which show that NRTI baseline mutations occur at about a rate of 9 to 13%, and I believe it was most commonly single mutation. So I do believe this is a very rare genotype to see.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We do have time for two more if you keep it short.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Pamina Gorbeck from UCLA. So I noticed that the patient had been treated for substance abuse, and I'm wondering if you have any information if he was currently injecting substances or if we know anything about that, because I think that the relevance of whether or not he was a injecting drug user or not would be very important for our sort of take home from this.
Yeah, the patient, in fact, was not a substance, had no history of substance abuse.
Oh, really? Sorry, I missed.
It's okay.
So you verified that he was not injecting?
He's never used IV drugs. my knowledge.
Orvi Parikh, University of Pittsburgh. I was wondering if you did any kind of sensitive analysis to see if there was low frequency K65R. I mean, with TIMS, you wouldn't expect it, but how heterogeneous the viral population might have been, yeah. Or if 184V was in all of the viruses seen.
So our standard consensus sequencing showed all the mutations that I had up on the slide. Our deep sequencing, which was done independently, didn't reveal any mutations at low frequencies in the viral pool.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.